Welcome to the Sagebrush Variety Show, sagebrushvariety.org, political commentary and satire. This week, on the Peak Oil Check-In, Carl Ettenayer discusses whether electricity can replace oil or not. On Corporate Prime, written by Kevin Bayhouse, our radio play about life after peak oil, we're on part three of this series. On the Sagebrush Variety Show Farm Report, we feature sunflowers. And on this week's essay, we take a look behind the scenes as sheep rancher's wife, Joanne Sheepsley Peasy, records a new essay in the radio studio. And a piece on male privilege. But first, Bucky Bacaw's Backyard Chicken Broadcast on everything you ever wanted to know about chicken poop. I'm producer Gwen Sankirico. Enjoy the show.
Bucky Bacaw here, host of Bucky Bacaw's Backyard Chicken Broadcast. I love collecting fresh eggs. I suppose I mention that on just about every show, don't I? And you'll hear it lots more, and not just on the upcoming egg episode. But today, I'm going to tell you about one thing I enjoy almost as much as harvesting eggs. The truth is, I really get a kick out of harvesting the day's chicken poop, which is good, because a typical full-size chicken will produce about 16 or 17 pounds of manure a year. My banties probably make a half to two-thirds that much. Now, first of all, chicken poop is not as stinky as a lot of people who don't have chickens think it would be. I guess stink is in the nostrils of the smeller. But still, I'm convinced that my flock's poop smells so sweet in part because my chickens eat only veggies and grains and bugs. No cannibalism chicken eating for them. No meat of other livestock. Not to mention, I don't feed them processed foods or added preservatives or chemicals like antibiotics. And it probably doesn't hurt that my chickens have a pretty large area to roam and poop in. When concentrated in a small area, like a coop, the smell of poop might start to be too much of a good thing. I do remember at one point last winter there was a lot of snow and my spoiled little chickens were spending a lot of time in the coop, and it did get a tad overpowering in there until I took 15 minutes to clean it out. Anyway, if you have any sense at all, you too will realize chicken poop has a wonderful fragrance, because you'll know that mixed into your compost pile, it's going to be an essential part of a green garden. You know, before the chemical fertilizer revolution, chicken manure was viewed as having pretty much equal value as eggs and meat as a usable product of chickenry. And it's worth noting that male chicks weren't routinely slaughtered to the extent they are now. It was okay to have an excess of roosters around because it meant that much more valuable fertilizer for the crops. Chicken manure is the richest animal manure in what green thumb types like to refer to as NPK composition. That's nitrogen and P for phosphorus and K, for some reason, for potassium. Most gardeners recommend chicken manure be composted before adding it to the garden because it's so rich in nitrates it will burn plants if applied directly. However, I gotta tell you, my partner has blended our flock's poop with our compost and added it to the garden without any aging period, as well as putting small amounts directly on our garden late in the season. And we haven't seen any burning. Still, just to be on the safe side, I've started working chicken manure into our composting schedule, especially since I learned that chicken manure helps compost break down faster. You may have heard that chicken litter has been blamed for introducing phosphorus to the water supply, leading to algal blooms. But keep in mind that this is the result of factory farming and the American appetite for vast quantities of meat. Small-scale farming, like backyard chickens, would never have that kind of impact. And for when we run out of auto fuel, which a lot of the show hosts here on Sagebrush Variety argue convincingly we will, you all ought to know that chicken manure can be converted into methane to run combustion engines. A small flock won't get you a lot of trips, but in a pinch. By the way, contrary to what a lot of people have told me they believe, chickens can indeed control when they poop. Maybe not forever, but they can hold it in, just like you probably. If I have a chicken on my shoulder and it needs to poop, she lets me know, and I have at least a full minute to put her down. That's because I have a good relationship with my chickens. Contrast that with field fare birds, who will attack as a group and bomb predator birds with their poop from the air. Chickens could probably poop as a defense too, so you better watch it. Finally, I thought I'd tell you about some of the medicinal uses of chicken poop I've come across. Sextus Empiricus, a Greek philosopher who lived in Alexandria and in Athens a couple thousand years ago, believed that boils could be burst by applying the dung of a red cock to them. At the time, there was a bit of a controversy in the medical field, since others suggested a white cock's dung was more efficient. In the 17th century, it was believed that chicken manure, taken internally, cured colic, pain in the womb, jaundice, gallstones, and urinary tract infections, and that the ashes of chicken dung sprinkled on the flesh dried running sores and scabs. Use of these folk remedies persisted in America until at least the 1800s. And what a lot of people don't realize is that processed extractions of poultry dung are still used in commonly known deodorants, dentifrices, mouthwashes, hair colorings, hand creams, lotions, and shampoos. If you don't believe me, do a web search on urea and cosmetics. I really can't recommend any of the older medical cures. I just don't have the courage to use chicken poop topically or internally, and I very rarely even use the cosmetics named above, but that's another story. At any rate, it just goes to show in what high esteem chicken manure was once held, and how even in this strange and squeamish day and age makes itself useful. So, no more of this wringing your hands about having chickens live in your backyard because you think you or your neighbor's going to find the smell offensive. That's just bullshit, which by the way is not so great. Remember, send in your questions, as an audio file would be extraordinary, at sagebrush@radioboise.org. Keep on tuning in. This is Bucky Bacall signing off. I had a good time. Bucky Bacall's Backyard Chicken Broadcast was produced by the Sagebrush Variety Show with support from Boise Community Radio and the Green Institute.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Earlier this month, on the 39th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11, the first spacecraft to carry humans to the surface of the moon, Al Gore proposed a challenge at least as bold as John F. Kennedy's 1961 challenge to land a man on the moon and bring him back safely by the end of the decade. Gore proposed that the United States commit to generating 100% of its electricity renewably and from what he called truly clean carbon-free sources within 10 years. He touted a combination of wind and solar for U.S. electricity needs. Regardless of whether 100% renewable electricity is achievable within 10 years, Gore's challenge is a sort of bold goal that we need at a time when business as usual is leading us off a cliff, economically, environmentally, and security-wise. For me, Gore's challenge is also an excuse to revisit comments I made at the beginning of this year about the possibilities of substituting electricity for oil. At the time, oil had just closed at $100 a barrel for the first time. How much can electricity substitute for oil? There are limits, partly because oil is an energy-dense liquid fuel. You can pour it in your gas tank and carry large amounts of energy long distances. Batteries don't store as much energy in a given weight or a tank size. Your house's oil tank can be filled in the summer and store that oil until cold weather sets in with virtually no loss. Batteries won't do that, either. Yet electricity can replace some uses of oil. For now, let's adopt Al Gore's bold vision and imagine 100% renewable generation of electricity within 10 years. Further, let's pretend that we can wave a magic wand and make that supply of electricity unlimited. Given an unlimited supply of electricity, how could we use it to substitute for oil? Only a tiny percentage of electricity in the U.S. is generated using oil, so there is little to be gained by replacing the oil with other fuels. Transportation. Now that's where the big oil uses are in the United States. Cars, trucks, buses, and airplanes account for 2/3 of U.S. oil consumption. Cars are the single biggest users, guzzling about 25% of all the oil we use. Plug-in hybrid cars could replace most of their gas use with electricity. Plug-in hybrids charge their batteries from the electric grid. For shorter trips, the batteries and an electric motor are all that's needed. For longer trips, a gas tank and gasoline engine provide the extra range. For many users, almost all daily trips could be within the range of the batteries, dropping gasoline use to nearly nothing. Other options are completely battery-driven cars, or cars that run on hydrogen made with electricity, from water. All this would take time. Even for technologies that have been successfully demonstrated, like electric cars, it takes time to gear up factories and begin production. Even if all the new cars and light trucks purchased from today onward were plug-in hybrids, it would still take 10 to 15 years to replace half the existing fleet at the rate people buy new vehicles. And, as world oil production declines, the economy is wobbling. In hard economic times, people tend to hold on to what they have rather than buying replacements, so the turnover time is becoming even longer. That's probably why Gore advocates subsidizing car companies to produce and sell plug-in hybrids. Electrifying buses, trolleys, and trains is also possible. These, too, take time and money. In sum, there's only room for marginal short-term replacement of oil with electricity. 2/3 of U.S. oil use is for transportation, and it would take a couple decades to retool our vehicles and our rails so that large amounts of electricity could power cars, buses, and trains. To be fair, Gore's proposal is focused primarily on phasing out coal by the end of the decade, and that would have a tremendous effect in reducing U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases. At a time when world oil exports are dropping, and projected to continue to drop, renewable electricity is not much of a solution for reducing oil dependence. A lot more reduction in oil use will probably come from simply less moving of our bodies and our stuff. As during World War II, people will ask, "Is this trip really necessary?" before going anywhere. We might even discover more of the treasures of our own country and become better friends with our neighbors. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Four months ago, I was living a whole different life. I was a security officer for the Corby City in the eastern part of Cascadia in the now defunct United States. It used to be the world's superpower until the oil wars that ensued a few decades ago. The wars were brought on by the decline of oil availability. That spurred all the world's military powers to hoard as much remaining oil and gas reserves as possible. Civil war reduced all of these countries to fractured has-beens. Within each nation-state, people warred with themselves over the table scraps of the natural resources needed to continue their decadent lifestyles. Life turned very dark after the oil wars left charred remains of what was once a functional society, smoking in the ruins of capitalist enterprise. I've been through a lot the last few years, but I probably shouldn't complain. I'm not sure there's any such thing as the easy life anyway, and lately I've been thinking we're better off without it. My name is David Ortega, and this is my story. Excuse me, I was wondering where I could get a meal. I'm just passing through town.
There's a few community diners around here. See that solar collector on the corner that looks like a tree? Take a left there and go one block to a sculpture garden, then take a right, and it's another two blocks to the Sagebrush Brewery. The diner's attached to the brewery.
Great. What can I trade for a meal here?
Well, if you tell them that you're traveling, they'll probably give you a free meal. Otherwise, you work it off. We have a local currency. You work and get currency for products or services. It's only good in the valley. Your other option is to barter something of value.
Thanks for your help.
No problem. Good luck.
Big Brother, this is Nomad. Over. Big Brother, do you copy? Over.
Roger, Nomad. We copy.
We mapped out the communication centers in Boise. The rest are in the next town to the west. Over.
Roger that, Nomad. Can you do reconnaissance on that town tomorrow? Over.
Affirmative. I'll catch the train there tomorrow morning. Over.
I copy, Nomad. What about energy centers? Over.
I found a few major substations that distribute power from the dam. They're generating the balance of the power with solar panels, wind, and geothermal. It's very decentralized. Over.
Roger that, Nomad.
I'll check in after I recon the West community. Over.
I copy, Nomad.
Nomad out.
Good luck, Nomad. Big Brother out.
Hi, is the seat taken?
No, be my guest.
Are you by chance going to Caldwell?
Actually, I haven't decided. I'm passing through and thought I'd look around.
Really? Where are you from?
I'm from Wyoming. I thought I'd go see what's happening on the coast. I'm thinking I might like to see Portland.
Portland's a decent city. They're one of the few places that had it together when peak oil hit. This valley's nice. I like it here. I'm from Colorado, originally. A couple of years ago, I got tired of slaving away at a corpy town near Denver. So I wandered westward and I found this community.
Did you come through Salt Lake City?
Yes, but I had to be careful. I didn't get permission to leave the corpy town I was living in. So they put out word that I might be moving west. I still worry sometimes that they might catch up with me.
I wouldn't worry about that much. Unless you went around blabbing that you're wanted by a corpy town, you can pretty much get away. It's not like they have electronic tracking systems and spy nets like there used to be before the collapse.
Yeah, I remember hearing about those extensive telecommunications snooping nets that the government used to track people with. My father said that he was charged with sedition by the government, and that they used electronic spy nets to track all of his calls and movements.
Why did they charge him with sedition?
Because he was a Quaker and strongly advocated for nonviolence. His group was very vocal in criticizing the government.
Huh. Were they dangerous or something?
No, they were just trying to get involved with decision-making to improve people's lives. That was the threat. Those controlling the system felt threatened by anyone trying to change the status quo.
You mean the old plutocracy, right?
Yeah, that's it.
I remember hearing about that from my parents. They never much cared about things like politics.
I think everyone living now might wish people had cared more about politics then.
My name's David.
I'm Monica. Good to meet you, David.
Why'd you ask me if I was heading to Caldwell?
Oh, I wanted to know if the Melba Cooperative was hiring people for the spring harvest yet. I figured that if you were from Caldwell, you might have heard about it.
Do you usually help with the harvest?
Yeah, I helped out last year and I made a lot of friends there. We all said we'd sign up again this year, even if just for the meals. I mean, everyone's encouraged to learn how to cook, and Boise has its specialties, but the meals there are just something else entirely.
Maybe I'll check them out with you, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. They usually need about 100 people for the harvest. Last year, they hired almost everybody that applied.
How's the work divided up?
Actually, we're still experimenting with different systems. One group of people are organizing around something called participatory economics. Paracon, for short. Others are just winging it, working wherever they need to, depending on their skills, basic barter and trade rules. We have a local currency system that makes it more flexible.
How does Paracon work?
It's an economic model that's based on equity, solidarity, diversity, and participatory self-management. That means everyone works together to make decisions about the actual jobs, the products being made, and giving everyone fair compensation for their work. The more you work, or the more demanding the work, the more you get in exchange for it.
Doesn't sound too bad. How do they decide who does what kind of work?
The local councils work together to decide what we need. How much food, what kind of machines we need, supplies for maintenance, upkeep of our energy sources, the basics to keep everyone fed, comfortable, and entertained. We figure out what the most efficient uses of our available resources are and make sure it's sustainable, too. We can't afford to crash our local economy. We make sure people who do the undesirable work get compensated fairly for it. And we also rotate jobs as much as we can so that no one gets stuck doing work they really don't like. This way all the necessary work gets done, it's fair, and people appreciate each other's roles.
How do you know so much about all this?
We really encourage education and debate around here. There's always discussion going on in our lives. Children are taught how to think critically early on. Have you ever heard of the Nader Principle?
No, what's that?
The Nader Principle is based on a simple question that a famous political activist named Ralph Nader used to cite. His parents used to ask him when he got home from school, "So, Ralph, what did you learn in school today? Did you learn how to believe, or did you learn how to think?" People here are taught how to think critically so that the obscene mistakes of the past don't happen again.
Are you saying that people of the past developed their beliefs through rote memorization of what was told to them by authority?
Exactly. My father told me that people in his day felt like they wanted to belong to the greater whole of what society was reflecting and offering, and that they suppressed their own common sense so that no one questioned their actions in critical terms. Even when outspoken people, like Nader, were trying to tell them that they needed to change course, their insatiable craving for the something-for-nothing lifestyle kept them from paying attention.
What exactly is a something-for-nothing lifestyle?
I think it means that people used to take too much for granted in the way things were made or how services were performed. Hardly anyone valued the sacrifices being made by people that live far away from them for their labor to create products for super low wages. People also consume things without accounting for the environmental impacts. My father told me how people constantly ignored the actual consequences.
Like what? Could you give me an example?
During the old capitalist days, most of the things people bought were made in other countries, mainly by very poor people that lived in conditions that we now might call normal, especially in corpy towns.
Some people think that corpy towns are more efficient and organized than any other form of community.
I disagree. I wouldn't even call a corpy town a community. It's incredible how corporate prime really believes they represent some sort of beacon of hope that promises to restore the old system, when they actually represent the very system that they claim to deplore.
What do you mean?
Well, for instance, they're always talking trash about communism, when they're practicing it themselves. Corpy towns are just manifestations of the worst aspects of communism. That's how they're organized. When peak oil killed expansionist markets, corporations had to find new ways to exist. They saw that they had to survive by embracing rules of sustainability and some kind of false community. They're authoritarian, much like the communists that they hate. My father used to laugh at them. He used to say that the corporate capitalists were hypocrites. They hated government regulations, but yet they acted like ruthless overlords. They hated the old social programs for poor people, but wanted the government to keep them alive with special corporate programs.
Why do you think they want to go back to the old ways if sustainability makes more sense?
Because before the collapse, there was a huge wealth disparity between rich and poor. The collapse destroyed that disparity. People resented the income gap and saw an opportunity to end it during the energy wars. No more rich, do-nothing fat cats to give the orders and reap all the profits from your hard work.
I remember hearing about that. My parents witnessed a lot of the energy wars here in the West. It was really horrific and bloody. But how did the corporations survive the public outrage?
They owned a lot of the resources, and they developed propaganda programs to paint themselves as the saviors of society. They kept preaching about how they could restore the high living standards of the good old days if people were willing to tolerate a temporary form of authoritarian collectivism.
Authoritarian collectivism. Communism.
No, that's the propaganda name for communism. My father always said that communism was deliberately described, inaccurately, as a political system, instead of the economic structure it really was. Capitalism was always being associated as inherently democratic, which is such a joke because the Chinese ran both capitalism and communism under a dictatorship. Political systems are separate from economic systems. You can combine them any way you want to.
Could a corporation be democratic?
I guess so, but there are few, if any, historical examples.
Do you think that the old systems will ever return?
The only way that could ever happen is if prices really reflected the impacts that they carry with them. And even then, I think there may be pitfalls. And corporate prime would probably like it, though.
I know this guy who thinks they can do it. He worships some guy named Milton Friedman.
Oh, that guy lives in a fantasy world.
You're pretty passionate about this stuff.
Everyone here is. That's what I like about it. This community will never fall victim to BS notions from the past that damn near wiped us all out. Everyone here knows how to think for themselves. This is Meridian. We'll be here for a while. I'm gonna stretch my legs.
Well, this is excellent news, Chief.
I told you Ortega was a good pick.
Right you were. Now we need to think about the next move. As soon as Ortega relays the infrastructure report, we can execute our plan.
Have you decided to tell Ortega about our real objective yet?
I'm playing that one by ear, Chief. I want to hear his reaction to what he finds first. Habib couldn't understand why we wanted to attack a seemingly peaceful and well-functioning society. He just couldn't understand the threat of their example. History is filled with these independent upstarts that always threaten to upend the status quo.
Well, I don't know much about history, Mr. Barraclaw.
Trust me, Chief. These independence movements are nothing but trouble. They don't understand the need for elite rule, and that's dangerous. Only a select group of well-informed men should make important decisions about economics and political needs. Great men lead great nations. Like Caesar, Napoleon, Reagan, Bush.
If you say so, Mr. Barraclaw.
I'm sorry, Chief. I don't mean to bore you.
Do you think we'll be able to wipe out these Aggies with a single strike?
I'm very optimistic, Chief.
Big Brother, this is Nomad. Do you copy? Over. Big Brother, this is Nomad. Do you copy? Over.
Roger, Nomad. We need you. Over.
I'll be in the Nampa area in approximately 1 hour. Over.
Copy that, Nomad. Over.
Tell Castle I'll need another day or two for recon. Over. Copy that, Big Brother. Are you positioned in the city? Over.
Roger, Nomad. Contact us at 2200 hours. Over.
I copy, Big Brother. Nomad out.
Big Brother, out.
Ah, you're still here.
Yeah. I'm eager to see Nampa.
There's really good farmland there. So, what do you do for fun?
Oh, I like to play cards. Poker, mostly.
Oh yeah? Me too. I like poker a lot. Do you ever get off the roads and go exploring?
I've always wanted to, but I never get the chance.
My friends and I like to go hiking in the Owyhees and the Sawtooths. It's a great way to see some real wilderness. There are some spots that barely manage to escape the effects of logging and ranching, and they're pretty different. You should come with us sometime.
Maybe I'll take you up on that. How long does it take to get out there? A week?
It depends on where you go, but usually about 3 days.
On foot?
No, on bicycles. It takes that long just to ride out there. Once we're there, we hike. The best places are accessible only by foot, like the slot canyons.
That really does sound great. It makes me depressed that I've spent all this time stuck in a corpy town.
Corpy town? Where have you been living?
I've been living in a corpy town. And just like you, I got tired of it and sort of left.
Left? Yeah, I know. You just get sick of it. So you think they'll care that you're missing?
I don't know, and I don't really care. We're pretty much home free now. It's totally free from here to the coast. No corpy towns in Oregon or Washington. Or Northern California, for that matter.
No corpy town cops to look for us this far west, right?
I really doubt it.
So... You like poker, huh?
Yeah, I do.
Well, if I can hook up with some of my friends later on, we can get a game together. Would you be interested?
Only if you and your friends don't mind losing.
Well, if you put it that way, maybe we should play Twister instead.
Twister? What's that?
Oh, you'd love it. It's sort of a board game.
The only board game I've ever played is one called Monopoly.
In the Corby Town?
Yeah.
That figures. So which Corby Town do you come from?
The one in eastern Idaho.
Isn't that near Arco City?
It is Arco City. They call it New Arco City now.
Ooh. Don't they get their electricity from the old nuclear site? What was it called? O-N-O-O-E-N-I-L-A-N-A-L.
It was called a bunch of things. But I think I-N-E-L was the most recent.
Do those reactors still work?
Well, they're down to a couple that still work. There used to be 50 or so out there, but they've been cannibalizing whatever they can to keep the last two running.
I'd imagine they'll have to shut down pretty soon, huh?
Oh, they're trying hard to get Corporate Prime to send them more parts from the Oak Ridge site in Tennessee. But compatibility issues and priorities may eventually force Arco to find a new power source.
Like what?
I don't really know. I don't think even they know.
They're gonna have to switch to renewable energy. That nuclear power is really crazy. France and Russia and all the other nuke users have already used up all the uranium deposits. Besides, no one will ship any waste to Nevada anymore. You can't get anyone to set foot in that state after the Yucca Mountain earthquake.
In New Arco City, we just bury the waste on the premises.
Wow. I heard that's what they did with their waste before peak oil hit, but I can't believe you guys are still doing that.
Yeah, that's what we're told to do. Monica, when we get to Nampa, can you show me where to find a radio station?
Sure. There's one near the train terminal. What do you want with the radio station?
I meant to send a message to a friend in Portland last night, but I didn't get around to it.
Portland, huh? Well, you should wait until after dark. The signal will be stronger then.
That's what I was told before.
It's true.
Hey, Monica, what kind of crops are growing out there in those fields?
Oh, those? They're a mix. We multi-crop most things, which gets away from that old monoculture model. The yields are much better.
Seems like it'd require a lot of work, though.
Yeah, but we actually have a lot of fun, and you don't do it for very long. And then you get a lot of time off. We're just about there. Welcome to Nampa, Cascadia.
Oh, that went fast. Can you still show me where the radio station is?
Yeah, sure. I'm in no hurry. But you have to play poker with me later.
Okay, that's a deal.
Corporate Prime by Kevin Bayhouse. We'll continue next week on the Sagebrush Variety Show. You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, political commentary and satire with an irreverent twist.
The Sagebrush Variety Show players have grown something in our yards for the past several years. We got started as gardeners for several reasons. Most importantly, a resistance to the predominance of pesticide-laced and genetically modified food that dominate the grocery stores. A desire for self-sufficiency and, to be honest, epicurean pretensions that were rarely satisfied by ingredients that were shrunk-wrapped, refrigerated, and trucked across continents. Some years, our activism took priority over all else, and our gardens suffered. We don't regret that, but in the ensuing years, big agribusiness has grown more and more predatory in their attempts to corner the food market. Pursuing multiple strategies from chemical saturation to trademark piracy, and even entering the organic market just to chip away at the standards as well as the values of that movement. Meanwhile, a post-oil economy is looking like it might come sooner than even we industry critics once anticipated. So this year, our garden is part of our activism,
After all, we always said that a major part of the Sagebrush Variety Show agenda is to make inedible lawns and the pesticides, water waste, and obnoxious mowers that make them possible an object of derision and scorn. But you know what? Forget about our politics. What we're growing tastes really good. Whether you're a fat cat neocon ordered by your doctor to back off the red meat or die, or a limousine liberal fond of the Food Network and public radio shows about rare wines, costly cheeses, and cows grown on remote Japanese islands, we're one up on you. Our harvests are so bodaciously fresh that even the most humble of vegetables makes your caviar pale in comparison. Are you going to sit back and let us have something you don't? And having the leisure time to putter about the garden can be a sign of status to all our comrades in the honest classes. If we can pull this off, so can you. Also, keep in mind that there are vegetables for every season and climate, so it's never too late to plant. The pick of the week for today's show is sunflower. Sunflowers are native to the Americas. In the Andes, the Incans viewed the sunflower as a living image of their sun god, and Incan priestesses wore sunflower jewelry of gold. European explorers brought seeds back to their nations in the 16th century, and the plant soon took root nearly all over the planet. In Russia, one reason for the sunflower seed's popularity was that the Russian Orthodox Church forbade the eating of oily plants during Lent, but because sunflower seeds were introduced after the prohibition, they were exempt. Russia is now one of the top three producers of sunflowers, along with Argentina and the U.S. Eastern Europeans adopted sunflower with such enthusiasm that when post-World War II immigrants brought the seeds with them to the United States, few people realized it was a homecoming rather than an immigration for the plants. Ironically, sunflowers were not commercially grown on a large scale in the U.S. until the 1970s. The sunflower was also reintroduced by Russian immigrants to Argentina, which is the other of the top three producers now. There is a Greek myth in which Clytie fell in love with Apollo, the sun god. She becomes obsessed with watching his chariot move across the sky, and after 9 days, she turns into a flower. There is confusion about this myth because the Greek word herantis literally means sunflower, even though the Greeks were originally referring to either marigold or heliotrope, other plants that follow the sun. Another misconception is that what is often thought of as the flower is actually the head of the plant, containing many individual flowers. The flowers and the seed they leave behind are arranged in an alternating spiral pattern, typically containing 34 spirals in one direction and 55 in the other. In large sunflowers, there may be 89 in one direction and 144 in the other. This is an example of what is known in mathematics as the Fibonacci series, formed by starting with 0 and 1, and then adding the latest two numbers to get the next one. For links to detailed discussion of the Fibonacci series in Nature, visit us on the web at sagebrushvariety.blogspot.com. Most flower heads on a field of blooming sunflowers are turned toward the east, where the sun rises each morning. Sunflowers in the bud stage follow the sun on its journey along the sky from east to west, returning at night to the eastward orientation. This is known as heliotropism. The motion is performed by motor cells in the pulvinus, a flexible segment of the stem just below the bud. The stem stiffens in a mature plant, leaving most sunflowers still frozen in the eastward orientation. In some wild sunflowers, the head doesn't follow the sun, but individual leaves may. Some cultivated versions have drooping heads, which are popular with commercial growers because it reduces yield loss to hungry birds. But they're not as pretty. Although maximizing yield can pose challenges for the commercial grower, sunflowers are relatively easy to grow in a variety of climates, so long as there is plenty of sunlight. In Belgium, there is a group called Brussels Farmer that started planting sunflower seeds in public spaces throughout that city. They are also called tournesol gorillas, tournesol being the French word for sunflower, and gorillas because their actions are not supported or sanctioned by the government entities in charge of the public space. Technically, their actions are probably illegal, but like gorilla gardening in other parts of the world, authorities aren't eager to arrest someone for planting flowers, although official city gardeners sometimes pull the plants. See our blog to link to their website and read their manifesto, which explains how their action brings more green to their city, takes back some of the territory that humans have taken from nature, and makes a statement regarding food from sunflower seeds and biofuel from sunflower oil. Sunflower seeds are a versatile cooking ingredient for a variety of soups, breads, spreads, pestos, and anything that could benefit from a dash of meaty crunch. Although some of us enjoy the experience of removing seeds from the hulls one at a time as we snack, others find this tedious. To de-hull your own seeds, try putting a few handfuls of seeds into a large plastic Ziploc bag and use a rolling pin to break up the shells. Dump the mess into a bowl of water and stir. Skim the floating shells from the top, then drain and dry the remaining seeds. If you really have to. For our taste test, we went for the direct experience of snacking on young seeds. Here are our reactions.
The light flavor of these fresh sunflower seeds is a snack to rival the roasted, salted variety. I prefer the supple texture and sprightly flavor of this floral fruit straight out of the garden. Extracting them from the blossom, then the shell, is a challenge well worth the effort.
The flavor onsets with a mild, sweet cream, followed by a pleasant pine tar tingle. The soft shells, while not edible, can be chewed like gum to extract the flavor. Too much exercise for many, I imagine, but I find it invigorating.
The delicate flesh is sweet, with a hint of pine and white mulberry, augmenting a woody maple base with a bright, delightful, earthy aftertaste.
It is born in glory on a circular palate that is the sunflower. The sunflower seeds are a finger food favorite. Not only is it nutritious, but is proudly worn by green parties of the world as their symbol.
If you like what you hear and want more information on growing this or other crops, visit our website at sagebrushvariety.org or email us at sagebrush@radioboise.org. Or, if you're already gardening, we'd love to hear what you're growing and eating and how you and your companions describe the experience. Tune in next week for more Sagebrush Variety Show Farm Reports. And remember, say no to corporate food. For writer and rancher Joanne Sheepsley Peasy, the first snowfall of the year always evokes joyful memories. On the ranch, though, too much snow can be a hardship.
Okay, ready? And we're rolling.
Snow, snow, snow! The fatter, fluffier, and frostier the flakes, the more delight they bring as they spiral down from the sky. There is nothing like the silence brought on by a major snowfall. So much movement, yet almost all the sound is absorbed by the crystals falling from above. During the first snowfall of the season, I always insist on taking a moment to stand in awe while the snow falls around me, letting my worries fade and even forgetting who I am as I gaze across a white landscape.
Whoops, you want to do another take on that?
That was fine. Why'd you stop me?
You said across instead of across.
I meant to say that. Now I have to start all over. This time, don't interrupt me.
Okay, ready? And we're rolling.
During the first snowfall of the season, I always insist on taking a moment to stand in awe while the snow falls around me, letting my worries fade and even forgetting who I am as I gaze across a white snowscape before me and think to myself absolutely nothing. This Zen state is a rare luxury for me, so it is fleeting, and once again I return my mind and body back to the wilderness that is known as Idaho. My peaceful state is soon challenged by the reality of being a rancher and all the responsibilities that come with the job. Last year, my serenity was shattered when I went into the house to do some chores and found a big, cold puddle in the middle of the bearskin rug in the living room. There was a leak in the roof that had... No, let me do that again. There was a leak in the roof.
Are you trying to say roof?
Hold on, I don't have it yet. Roof.
I think your choices are limited to roof and roof.
They say roof in Idaho.
I think it's roof, actually. But if you say roof, that would be fine.
No, it's not fine. I have to sound like an Idahoan.
Joanne, please let's go with roof.
Please, you're rushing me. You know I can't work under stressful conditions.
You're obsessing, Joanne. Just say the line again. Let's go on.
Fine.
Okay. And we're rolling.
There was a leak in the rough that had worked its way through the ancient structure.
Let's try that again.
What was wrong with that?
There was a long pause and he said roof funny.
Well, you understand the word. Why couldn't you just leave it in?
You sounded really artificial. Let's do it over.
You're really pushing it. Just let me do my job and you do yours. I'm a professional. I know exactly how I want things to sound.
It's my job to make sure you are listenable.
How dare you? I'm very listenable. If I weren't, I wouldn't be the most famous writer rancher in the West.
You're listenable at all, and barely at that, only because of my direction. And if you want to keep receiving grants from all the sheep and cattle industries to fund your illusory existence, I suggest you learn to take direction.
Who do you think you're talking to? My father was—
Okay, you two. We're not getting any younger. Let's just finish this session, all right? Joanne? Are you ready?
Of course I'm ready.
Rolling.
There was a leak in the roof that had worked its way through the ancient structure over the ravages of time upon this historic ranch house. I called my husband on his cell phone and told him to come to the house quick, lest we find ourselves submerged in melting snow. Living on a ranch in the wilderness doesn't afford a person such city luxuries as calling a rougher to come out and fix things. Here my husband and myself have to roll up our sleeves and do things ourselves. Now what?
The engineer's right. Do that last line again and substitute I for myself.
I prefer to use myself.
I prefer that you did not. It's improper usage of that word. You're supposed to say I. I have to roll up my sleeves, not myself have to roll up my sleeves. You sound like a cavewoman.
Same difference. The simple folk always say myself, and the last thing I want to do is come off as hoity-toity.
Joanne, I won't let you participate in perpetuating the already highly confused perceptions of how to use I, me, and myself. Now stop wasting time. Please, just say I. We're rolling.
Here, my husband and I have to roll up our sleeves and do things ourselves if we want to get anything done at all. That means dropping everything and rounding up the appropriate ranch hands and the right tools for the job. We did a stunning cold patch that day, even while it was still snowing. And as for the bearskin rug, well, old Fozzie Bear hung to dry by the fire and eventually made a magnificent recovery and was restored to his former glory on the floor. There was another year when I was riding out to inspect the sheep when the first snowfall hit. We had just driven the herds from their summer grazing grounds through a major resort town to their winter grazing lands. It was a thick snow, although the temperature was not cruel and there was no wind, so it was...
Joanne, just do that again.
I'm trying, okay? Get off my ass. It was a very thick snow, although the temperature was not cruel and there was no wind, so it was another very serene snow. The sky opened up and dropped dense snowflakes just as I approached Vagina Creek on my horse. The sight of the water trickling over the smooth stones as the snowflakes hit the mirror-like surface of the water. No, wait, I'd need to do that again. The sky opened up and dropped dense snowflakes as I approached Vagina Creek on my... Vagina Crick. The sky opened up and dropped dense snowflakes just as I... The sky opened up and dropped dense snowflakes just as I approached Vagina Crick on my horse. The sight of the water trickling over the smooth stones as the snowflakes hit the mirror-like surface of the water had a hypnotic effect. I'm certain that after 30 seconds, my blood pressure dropped dramatically just from taking in the loveliness of the winterscape. By the time I had ridden back to the ranch house, enough snow had fallen for fun and games. The ranch hands, who are giddy like children, never having seen snow before, had seen me approaching the house and were hiding with my husband behind the hay bales. When they came within range, they mischievously jumped out in front of me and playfully pelted me with snowballs. Unfortunately, they spooked my horse and...
Mischievously. Take it again from when I came.
When I came within their range, they mischievously jumped out in front of me and playfully pelted me with their...
It's mischievous. Mischievously.
Mischievous?
Mischievous.
It's like serious. Serious, seriously. Mischievous, mischievously.
Joanne, do you even know how to spell mischievous? There's no I in that last part. That's wrong. The word is mischievous. Little kids make that mistake. You're pushing 60.
I'm a celebrated writer. Words are my business.
The sheep are your business.
My God, how dare you? This is my writing style.
Actually, sheep isn't your business. It's your husband's business.
You have no idea what it's like to be
an artist. You don't know the front end of a sheep from the back end.
I'm to the spirit of the humble folk of this state, and you are f***ing with
you
that. So stop it.
You're just a huge phony. Go back to Connecticut.
How dare you? I am a real Idaho, and this is my...
fake...
Shut up!
Worst writer I've ever heard. You were right like a five-year-old.
Shut up and let me
do. You're right like a five-year-old Nazi in a foreign language.
It's been my experience, particularly in the Western U.S., that the biggest problem with feminism is that it's often mistaken for female supremacy. Allow me to set the record straight. Feminism is all about gender equality for everyone, not just women. So unless you believe that some people should be treated better than others based on their gender, you should be a feminist too. Another thing I've noticed is that many men and women in Idaho who call themselves feminists still don't get it. Female sexuality is commodified and stringently forced down our throats all our lives, everywhere we look. Yet these people say they believe in equality, but don't make the connection to the concept of female sexuality being a thing that can be bought and sold as a problem. They don't comprehend how sexism is a problem. The first steps are to acknowledge that sexism exists and how it affects people. Then, understanding that certain portions of the population are in a position of privilege. Straight men can take so much for granted that women have to face every second of every day. I present our reading of The Male Privilege Checklist by Barry Deutsch, based on an essay by Peggy McIntosh entitled White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. We let the sagebrush men handle this one.
My odds of being hired for a job when competing against female applicants are probably skewed in my favor. The more prestigious the job, the larger the odds are skewed.
Oh, I can be confident that my coworkers won't think I got my job because of my sex, even though that might be true.
If I am never promoted, it's not because of my sex.
If I fail in my job or career, I can feel sure this won't be seen as a black mark against my entire sex's capabilities.
The odds of my encountering sexual harassment on the job are so low as to be negligible.
If I do the same task as a woman, and if the measurement is at all subjective, chances are people will think I did a better job.
If I am a teen or adult and I can stay out of prison, my odds of being raped are so low as to be negligible.
I am not taught to fear walking alone after dark in average public spaces.
If I choose not to have children, my masculinity will not be called into question.
If I have children but do not provide primary care for them, my masculinity will not be called into question.
If I have children and provide primary care for them, I'll be praised for extraordinary parenting if I am even marginally competent.
If I have children and pursue a career, no one will think I'm selfish for not staying at home.
If I seek political office, my relationship with my children or who I hire to take care of them will probably not be scrutinized by the press.
Chances are my elected representatives are mostly people of my own sex. The more prestigious and powerful the elected position, the more likely this is to be true.
If my day, week, or year is going badly, I need not ask of each negative episode or situation whether or not it has sexist overtones.
As a child, chances are I was encouraged to be more active and outgoing than my sisters.
As a child, I could choose from an almost infinite variety of children's media featuring positive, active, non-stereotype heroes of my own sex. I never had to look for it. Male heroes were the default.
As a child, chances are I got more teacher attention than girls who raise their hands just as often.
I can speak in public to a large group without putting my sex on trial.
I can turn on the television or glance at the front page of the newspaper and see people of my own sex widely represented, every day, without exception.
If I'm careless with my financial affairs, it won't be attributed to my sex.
If I'm careless with my driving, it won't be attributed to my sex.
If I buy a new car, chances are I'll be offered a better price than a woman buying the same car.
If I have sex with a lot of people, it won't make me an object of contempt or derision.
There are value-neutral clothing choices available to me. It is possible for me to choose clothing that doesn't send any particular message to the world.
My wardrobe and grooming are relatively cheap and consume little time.
I can be confident that ordinary language of day-to-day existence will always include my sex. All men are created equal. Congressmen, chairmen, freshmen, he.
If I'm not conventionally attractive, the disadvantages are relatively small and easy to ignore.
I will never be expected to change my name upon marriage, nor question if I don't change my name.
I can ask for legal protection from violence that happens mostly to men without being seen as a selfish special interest, since that kind of violence is called crime and is a general social concern. Violence that happens mostly to women is usually called domestic violence or acquaintance rape, and is seen as a selfish special interest.
Every major religion in the world is led primarily by people of my own sex. Even God in most major religions is usually pictured as being male.
My ability to make important decisions, and my capability in general, will never be questioned, depending on what time of the month it is.
If I have a wife or girlfriend, chances are we'll divide up the household chores so that she does most of the labor, and in particular, the most repetitive and unrewarding tasks.
The decision to hire me will never be based on assumptions about whether or not I might choose to have a family sometime soon.
If I have children with a wife or girlfriend and it turns out that one of us needs to make career sacrifices to raise the kids, chances are we'll both assume the career sacrifice should be hers.
Most major religions argue that I should be the head of my household, while my wife and children should be subservient to me.
I am not expected to spend my entire life 20 to 40 pounds underweight.
If I have children with a wife or girlfriend, chances are she'll do most of the childbearing, and in particular, the most dirty, repetitive, and unrewarding parts of childbearing.
I can be somewhat sure that if I ask to see the person in charge, I will face a person of my own sex. The higher up the organization the person is, the surer I can be.
Magazines, billboards, television, movies, pornography, and virtually all of media is filled with images of scantily clad women intended to appeal to me sexually. Such images of men exist, but are much more rare.
I can be loud with no fear of being called a shrew. I can be aggressive with no fear of being called a bitch.
If I'm heterosexual, it's incredibly unlikely that I'll ever be beaten up by a spouse or lover.
I have the privilege of being unaware of my male privilege.
This week's Sagebrush Variety Show was conceived, written, performed, and produced by Robert McMinn, Kevin Bayhouse, April Hoy, and Gwen Sankirico, and was funded in part by a grant from the Green Institute. For more information on the content discussed on this program, visit our website at sagebrushvariety.org. Write to us at sagebrush@radioboise.org. Thanks for listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show.